For Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up, the final installment of the series, Matters of Principle, explores the complex demands placed on school leadership on the last day of the school year. What's cooking in the kitchen? Meet Lynn Rossetto Casper, the host of the radio show The Splendid Table, which is joining the weekend lineup here on NPR 89.1. And I'll talk with award-winning mystery writer Craig Johnson, the creator of the best-selling Sheriff Walt Longmire series, which has now been adapted for TV. Those stories are all next, here on Arizona Spotlight. All this week, we've been following the journey of a brand new principal at a rural school and a retiring principal in an urban area. Both of them led elementary schools this year, and Arizona Public Media's Fernanda Echavarri was there to document their challenges and victories along the way. From the first day of school, when the new principal chased stray dogs off the playground before dawn, to winter, when the retiring principal waited to see if her school would be closed because of budget cuts. By springtime, both principals were dealing with the pressures of Ames testing, all while helping children work through emotional and behavioral problems. In this final installment of Matters of Principle, Fernanda Echavarri brings us stories from the last day of the school year.
And today for lunch, last day of school. I know everybody's excited like I am.
That's Jim Heinzelman, the principal at Sapori Elementary School. He's making the last announcement for this school year. He's more comfortable speaking to the school now than he was in August on his first day as a principal. Looking back at his first year in school leadership, Jim says it has changed him.
This isn't just a career. Truly, now that I'm principal, this is my life.
His first year as a principal in the small town of Amado, Arizona, was a roller coaster ride. He not only had to get used to the role as the boss, he also had to start fresh in a new community. When asked about his favorite memories, all of Jim's examples describe times when students were happy.
It's hard to pinpoint just one because, you know, I think back to the celebrations that I've had with staff, which were great. Walking through classrooms and teaching lessons for the class just to assist the teachers to see what my expectation is for instructional purposes.
He says those visits were more beneficial to him than he had expected, especially because his first year as a principal in the Sahuarita Unified School District included state and federal elections, changes to standardized testing, and training for Common Core and new state reading requirements. Jim says he has a new list of goals for next year, and this summer he's going to create more programs that reward students' positive behavior.
One of my other goals next year is just to become more visible within the community. I don't live down here, so, you know, I've done various steps to become ingrained within the community down here, but just making myself seen. If it's at the bus stop, it's at the bus stop. This summer it will be at the pool. So just making sure that people see me and know that I'm here to stay. And that was one of their major concerns when the principal changed last year was, you know, are you going to get somebody in here who's going to stay, or are they going to be leaving in a year?
Jim says he expected the job as a school principal to be challenging, demanding, and rewarding. But he says he didn't expect to be standing on a porch telling a mother that her child couldn't go to school because of discipline issues.
And like this morning, one of the young men that I had have stay home the last couple days of school, I stopped at the bus stop this morning, and then I stopped at his house. Even though he's a sixth grader moving on to middle school next year, that kid means the world to me. So that kid won't be forgotten. By God, I'm going to be down there and seeing that kid for the next several years to make sure that he does graduate.
Jim says he can't change the world in a year, but he hopes he made a difference. This is also Lisa McCorkle's last day of school, But for this principal, it is her last day of school in this role. She's spending her day reading to students and visiting classrooms. The exceptional education students she's reading to are also spending their last day at Dietz Elementary School, because next year they will be moved to another school in order to make room for incoming students. Lisa's school is taking on more students next year because the Tucson Unified School District is closing 10 schools this summer. Lisa has been the principal at Dietz for more than 12 years and says retiring won't be easy.
I did wake up this morning thinking this is very strange because this is the last time that I'm going to wake up and have a last day of school in the same way that I have had it really pretty much the last 35 years.
Lisa was an elementary school teacher for more than 20 years before becoming a principal and says she was born to be in a school.
At the end, when the kids are leaving and they're hugging me and there's tears and they're thanking me and parents are thanking me, where else could you get this but in education? And as hard as it is, and it's been hard, as hard as it is to work in public education, the rewards are great.
The last couple weeks of school, Lisa says everyone at Dietz Elementary was emotional.
I told the kids in the program they did for me last week that they will always have a very special part in my heart.
Lisa had planned to retire twice before, but stayed a few more years. This time she will retire, but will not leave TUSD completely. She has a part-time job coaching principals in the district next year.
All the things that I've learned, I can share with new principals or help them through situations.
Just before Lisa makes her last announcement, she sits down to catch her breath after running around saying goodbyes.
7 minutes, and that will be the end of my career with kids in a school in this manner.
You have a beautiful day, you have a beautiful life, and I love you all, and I'll dance out the school with you now in just a few minutes.
Here we go!
Lisa, her students, and her staff are dancing their way out of school into the parking lot. Dozens of kids give her hugs one by one as they get into the school buses. The buses leave, and Lisa stands on the sidewalk, waving goodbye as they drive away. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Fernanda Echavarri.
You can hear the entire Matters of Principal series and see some photos online at azpm.org. The motto of The Splendid Table is the radio show for people that love to eat. Every week, host Lynn Rossetto Casper and her guests do their best to make stomachs rumble, mouths water, and imaginations race over new recipes and ways to brighten up a meal. The Splendid Table will join this station's weekend lineup starting on Saturday, and they gave me a chance to talk with Lynn Rossetto Casper about the show.
We're a show that looks at food from just about every imaginable angle. Actual cooking, humor, politics, science, the environment. And what you hear are generally interviews with people from all kinds of backgrounds. For instance, I think the first show you folks are going to be hearing, we're going to be interviewing Michael Moss, who has written the book Salt, Sugar, Fat. And he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the New York Times. And he's done a book where he spent a great deal of time with executives from the food industry. And he looks at how, supposedly, the food industry uses these three elements, which are extraordinarily appealing to we humans, in ways that make us want to have more of what they're selling. You know, the secret behind why we can't resist fast food. So there's something that's about what we're dealing with day to day, you know, which of course ties into the obesity epidemic and our concerns over our health. But then we have, on the flip side, Ted Allen, you know, who's the host of Chopped, it's on the Food Network. Ted talks about how to get out of food ruts. Ted cooks all the time. But the other thing is, Ted is surrounded by some of the best chefs and food minds in the country. And he has some dynamite ideas of tricks you can use to start yourself thinking down different paths. And again, whether you cook or not, it's kind of ways to get some variety into your life. And this is one of the things that's so interesting about doing. We've done this show for 18 years. When we first started the show, we talked about local, sustainable, and organic. And we always had to explain it. I don't have to explain it anymore when I mention it on the air.
That's true.
There you go.
Have you seen a big change in the way that Americans sort of relate to food and the growth of food culture over these 18 years?
It's huge, Mark. It is huge. The different, not just the awareness of where our food comes from, but it's sort of now, if you're smart, you know, if you have any savvy about where you live, the culture you're in the middle of, you have some sense of food. Now, I have to qualify this. First of all, my anecdotal figure is something like this. 60% of the people who listen to this show and are fans of it have no intention of walking into a kitchen under their own volition. And that's really wonderful to me, because the point here is that what we've discovered is food is far more than cooking. Don't misunderstand me. I think it would be wonderful if everyone cooked their own food and fed themselves. But we're looking at food now in very different ways. It used to be food history books, you know, you'd write one and five relatives would buy it and a couple of libraries, and then it would be gone. And today, I mean, several years back, we had a book on the history of a fish, cod, on the New York Times bestseller list for I don't know how long. This book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, which is a critical look at our food and why we're drawn to it and what this all means in terms of the science and the methods of marketing. This is on the bestseller list. Wouldn't have happened 20 years ago.
Here in Tucson, we're really lucky to be a crossroads for a lot of different things and a lot of different cultures. And we have an amazing array of restaurants here. But what, when you think of this region of the country, Lynn, do you have any dishes that come to mind or anything that you, get excited about in terms of Southwest cooking?
Oh, my. I have to confess, I've spent some time in Arizona and want to spend a lot more. Because we lived in Denver for a period of time, I spent a fair amount of time in New Mexico. And what I think is the thing I think of is at times the utter simplicity of the food. But when you talk about this idea of eating local, you know, which has a lot of threads to it, supporting an economy, supporting local manufacturers, all of that. But the other thing is that I always think of the Southwest and the aliveness of the food. When I eat in these little places, you know, where the tamales are being made by hand, the masa is, you know, even sometimes being done from complete scratch, there is a vitality. And, you know, lunch may be $5, but I think of it as this incredible vitality. And it's such a lean environment. You know, this isn't Arizona and New Mexico and Texas. This is not land that's lush and green. This is land where anything that grows struggles. And there are very intense flavors that come out of that. Never mind the fact that I will do anything for a good chili, whether it be the dish or the pepper.
Yeah.
And the idea of really wonderful handmade taco, oh, enough to just make you swoon.
The Splendid Table with host Lynn Rossetto Casper has joined the NPR 89.1 weekend schedule, Saturdays at 1 p.m. You can also find lots of recipes and more foodie excitement on the Splendid Table webpage at splendidtable.org. Coming up, how does a middle-aged Wyoming lawman and single father keep his chaotic life in balance? Author Craig Johnson says that his main character doesn't, and that's half the fun of writing about him. Stay tuned for a conversation next on Arizona Spotlight. Welcome back to Arizona Spotlight. Mystery writer Craig Johnson has just published a new novel called A Serpent's Tooth, and it's the ninth book in his best-selling series about a Wyoming sheriff named Walt Longmire. Johnson has also had the chance to see his literary creation come to life as the series was adapted for television. The show Longmire is starting its second season on the A&E network this week. Craig Johnson and his wife Judy live in a town in Wyoming called Ucross, where the population is a bustling 25. I talked with author Craig Johnson about what makes Walt Longmire tick last February on a particularly snowy Wyoming morning.
Oh, it's not too bad today. Like, it was snowing for the last day and a half or so. So we had to try to dig our way out down to the county road, which is about a half a mile, quarter of a mile. So I've got an old 1948 8N tractor that I use, and everybody makes fun of it like that, but it can lift about twice the amount of snow that I can. So I enjoy having it, I have to admit.
When you clear that path out to the county road, though, where's that road going to take you?
That road is kind of like the road less traveled, like that, but it actually goes up through away from Buffalo and away from Sheridan, which are the two larger cities in our portion of the central part of northern Wyoming, up near the Montana border, like that, and leads out into the Powder River country, away from the Bighorn Mountains, into what we euphemistically refer to as the UCLA area. You cross Claremont, Leiter, and Arvada, and not a single one of those towns has a population over 300.
Well, Craig, what road do you take to get to Absaroka County?
That all I have to do is just climb up into the loft of my log house and slip the headphones on, put on a little bit of music like that, and sit down with the laptop there and just take off and go. It's a fictitious county. There are 23 counties in Wyoming, and Absaroka County is the 24th county. And I get asked that question a lot. I mean, a lot greater authors than myself like that have decided to take a more fictional route, you know, whenever it was they were deciding to write their books. And I think what happened for me was that I was doing ride-alongs with the local sheriff in Johnson County, and, he had the first two chapters of The Cold Dish, my first Walt Longmire novel, and he calls me up on the phone and he says, well, you got a mistake right here in the first chapter. And I said, well, what's that? And he says, well, when you take a right on Fort Street, the next street up on the left is not Aspen. And I thought, oh, I am not going to fight that for the rest of my life. So I think what I decided was that it would be nice to have a little bit of creative license, you know, and not have to argue about every single landmark and every single person that was in the books. And that's kind of how I came up with the fictitious county in Wyoming.
Well, I imagine it's fun, too, because you do get to play with things. And if you want to say, you know, they've got the best blueberry pie in the world in Absaroka County, you can say that. I don't know if you have blueberries in Wyoming.
No, we really don't. Like that. The old statement is that there's a good-looking woman behind every tree out in the Powder River country. The problem is there aren't any trees. But I think what it also does is it does allow me to have that universality of the human condition, which I think, you know, that Steinbeck used to refer to, and that, I'm able to take bits and pieces, you know, from not only every county in Wyoming, but, you know, counties in Montana and Colorado and South Dakota, all over the country. I get emails from people saying, you know, they hear about the troubles that Walt has with the ladies that work at the DMV, you know, at the courthouse, and their remarks are always like, you've been to our county, haven't you? Like that. So there's kind of a universal quality to a lot of those things, and it allows me that kind of a freedom to make sure that those things make it into that community that's in the books, because, you know, for me, that's the important part, is that, you know, not just people from Wyoming or from the High Plains region, you know, the Rocky Mountain region, connect with these books. You know, they've been translated into a number of foreign languages, and so that universality that Steinbeck talks about, that's something that I'm always shooting for.
So knowing that you have a ranch and seeing your photos online where you got your cowboy hat and you're driving your truck and everything, but also hearing you quote Steinbeck and Studs Terkel, it brings to mind kind of a romantic image of you out riding out on the range at night, reading by moonlight, the kind of campfire scholar kind of thing. How close is that to reality?
I'd say that's probably very good, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
I came from a family of readers, like, and so, you know, for anybody in my family, our idea of hell was to be caught somewhere without a stack of books, you know, nearby, like that. And so, you know, no matter where I go, I always have books with me, like that. And, you know, people always ask, you know, how did you become a writer? Like that. Well, I started out as a reader. And, to me, that's essential. You know, I like to use that breath and whiff of literature that's out there, you know, because you challenge yourself, you know, by the writers that came before, you know, and the writers that I really like are the ones that have, you know, something, you know, really important to say. I mean, I really like the Steinbecks, the Hugos, the Dickenses, the writers that, you know, felt as though there was, you know, there were large issues at stake like that, but they also knew that to talk about those issues and to make them relatable, you know, to the reader, you had to bring them down to a human scale. I mean, I can talk about honesty, I can talk about justice, I can talk about all of these what I tend to refer to as mural words, but you know, you really need to break them down and, you know, try and show something, you know, that's on a human scale, you know, and that's where the characters come into play. And I think that's one of the essential elements as far as that kind of writing is concerned. And so, you know, for me, it's not a question of being trapped, you know, where I am. It's kind of out in the middle of nowhere, yeah, like that. But, you know, I've got all of these pieces of literature to keep me busy and to keep me occupied.
Well, let's talk about the central character of your series for a moment then, and talk about how much of you is really in the character of Walt Longmire, or maybe is it vice versa?
You know, my wife has the best statement about that. She says that Walt Longmire is who I would like to be in 10 years, but I'm off to an incredibly slow start. you know, it's kind of the way I look at Walt, too. I mean, I really enjoy his company. I mean, whenever I wrote The Cold Dish, the first book in the series, you know, it wasn't supposed to be a series of books at all. It was supposed to be a standalone book. Because when I wrote The Cold Dish, it was kind of like War and Peace in Absaroka County. It was, you know, like over 600 pages long. Because I figured, you know what, if I fooled them into allowing me to, you know, publish one book, they're never going to publish another one. And I was lucky, like that they really did. Like that, not only did they want to publish more books, but they wanted more of these books themselves. And the big question there became, okay, well, do these characters have, you know, more things to say? Do they have more stories to tell? And the answer came back, yeah, they probably did. And the other thing was, I really enjoyed Walt's company. You know, he's the books are written in first person, you know, and so you're kind of in Walt's head, you know, for 350, 400 pages like that. And it's not a bad place to be. I mean, he's intelligent, he's funny like that, he's good company. He's not perfect. By any way, shape, or form.
What's his shortcoming?
Oh, he has numerous shortcomings. Like that, you know, he's what I tend to refer to as over. You know, he's a little overweight. He's a little overage. He's a little overly depressed. You know, so he's got a lot of things working against him. But you know, the thing is he still gets up every morning and he still goes out there and, you know, and tries to do the job. And I think a lot of people, you know, can that kind of personification. I think it's something that people can, you know, relate to.
So hearing that description of Walt Longmire, do you find those qualities in Robert Taylor, the actor who plays him in the new A&E series?
You know, the really wonderful quality that that I think that Robert brings to the show is, well, a couple of different things. I mean, when they were devising the television show, when Warner and A&E were putting this together, they had two options. They could either go with somebody who was a really big name that would draw an audience, you know, to the television show, or they could go with someone who was a relative unknown. And it's difficult to find somebody, you know, that's that age. I mean, Walt's no spring chicken, you know, but you need to find somebody that's that maybe hasn't, you know, been as huge, you know, as some of the names that they were looking at. And so I was kind of rooting for the unknown actor that was out there like that. And I was very, very pleased when they came up with Robert Taylor like that. And I have to admit, everybody asks me, they say, you know, what's the biggest difference between the Walt in the books and the Walt on the television show? And my immediate response is, he's a lot better looking. You know, right off the bat, everybody in the show was a lot better looking than the people that I've had in my head, you know, for the last 9 years. But one of the things I think Robert does really, really well is that, you know, they had two options also on as far as the narrative of the books, the narrative of the television show was concerned. They could either have a voiceover or they could just let, you know, Robert act, you know, the role, and you could try and see the wheels turning and understand what it is that he's thinking rather than, you know, some really horrible voiceover like that. Even though Robert has a really fantastic voice, like that, he kind of makes Sam Elliott sound like a sissy. It's just one of those things where I think, you know, he just fits the role. His genetic coding really fits the role. And I remember watching, you know, his audition on the DVDs, which was, you know, just kind of miraculous in itself. There were a couple of things that really kind of blew me away. First of all, the way he moves like a Westerner. And then the thing that really got me was the fact that, you know, in the audition, he's going to a woman's house and he's informing her that her husband is dead and that he's not coming home. And he's never been in this woman's house. And when he walks into her home, he did something that none of the other actors did. He took off his hat. And I thought, how marvelous. We don't have to teach him basic civility. You know, he gets it. You know, and I thought that that was pretty wonderful.
Where does the bulk of your research or your firsthand knowledge with the police procedural form come from? I mean, what kind of special research did you do to write that aspect of the books?
The biggest thing is that, you know, it's always going to be primary research material because sheriffing is a very specific style of law enforcement that's very different from a lot of the stuff that's out there. I mean, you know, people are, you know, writing about detectives in New York and L.A. and Chicago and places like that. And so that's kind of the norm. I mean, you go home and you turn on the television and there will be 47 different CSI or all those type of shows like that. But with sheriffing, it's a little bit different. The bailiwick, the realm of influence is much wider. I mean, you're responsible for a lot more than just basic law enforcement aspects. The other thing is that that's very different from any other form of law enforcement is that you're not only a policeman, you're also a politician. I mean, it's the only elected form of law enforcement in the United States. And so not only do you have to be able to do the job, but you also have to be able to get votes or else you're out selling used cars after 4 years. So for me, that really was an element that drew me to this specific, you know, point of law enforcement. And then also the attachment, you know, that Walt has to his community. It seems like, you know, to go back to that character we were talking about before, that 6'2" of twisted steel and sex appeal kind of character, they really don't have much of an attachment to the community. And for me, you know, sheriffing seemed like something that would be more unique. And so what I did with a lot of times is I did a lot of ride-alongs and spent a lot of time with a lot of sheriffs and asked a lot of questions. That primary research material has served me very well, I have to admit.
Every week on the show, What Do You Know?, Michael Feldman asks people, if we came to your town, what's the first thing you'd show us? Where would you take us?
So, I'd take you to the Busy Bee Cafe. That's what I'd do, right there on Main Street in Buffalo.
And what do you recommend?
Probably the usual, you know, what it is that Walt orders up every time. And it's different every time he orders it.
But he calls it the usual?
Yes. It's the owner and chief bottle washer, like that, Dorothy, the one who owns the Busy Bee Cafe, like that, whenever Walt comes in, she says, "You want the usual?" He never knows what the usual is, like it, and she deserves it to applicant, and it's different every single time he gets it.
To promote the release of his new Walt Longmire mystery, A Serpent's Tooth, Craig Johnson will be making two appearances at local bookstores in June. On Wednesday, June 12th, Johnson will be in Tucson at Clues Unlimited. Then he heads to Phoenix to appear at The Poisoned Pen. There's a link for more information online at azpm.org. Thank you for listening to Arizona Spotlight. This show originates from the AZPM radio studios. The production engineer is Jim Blackwood. The music is by Calexico. I'm Mark McLemore.